Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general, and today about snow sports. Joining me in the studio here is guest co-host Chris Cherniak. He's filling in while Tim Henney is out on assignment.
That's right.
And as I said, today on The Mountain Life, we're celebrating the snow. And all we're talking about this hour is varying takes on what matches up so well with our snow, and that is snow recreation.
Really?
Yeah, okay. It really does.
Is that what matches
recreation
up?
And snow, they
Not
go together.
Staying inside?
Peanut butter
okay.
and jelly.
All right. That's right. We'll begin with our annual date with Paul Daigle. He's the director of the Utah Avalanche Center.
And then it's that growing but still little-known sport called ski-mo. That's ski mountaineering. What is it? Well, we'll speak with local resident Chad Bracklesburg of Utah ski-mo to hear all about it.
Finally, trail guru Bob Radke will join us to talk about some new winter trails in the area, those that will get cross-country skiers very excited, groomed to a corduroy perfection for both you and your pup.
Okay. I like that.
You like that?
Yeah.
Like, all right.
Uh-huh. My pup loves corduroy.
Is that...
But, you know, when you think about a dog and corduroy, that doesn't really go together because they ruin the corduroy.
Where are we going with this?
I don't know. Anyway, let's go to underwriter break.
Okay.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, this is JP, rental and repair manager for Cole Sport, a local KPCW supporter. Our ski and snowboard tune center is ready to go with precision tuning equipment from Montana of Switzerland and wax supplies from Swix and Wend. Open daily with overnight service at 4 locations, let's have another great season in Park City. Cole Sport. Expect the unexpected.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, joined by my guest co-host Chris Cherniak of This Green Earth fame.
That's right. Thanks, Lynn, for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. It's always fun to have you. Well, know before you go. That's the mantra of the Utah Avalanche Center, and that mantra exists, they hope, in the minds of every skier, snowmobiler, snowshoer, hiker, what else?
Biker.
Yeah,
fat biker.
That puts themselves out there, possibly in harm's way. Paul Daigle is the executive director of the Utah Avalanche Center. He heads up the nonprofit side, two sides to the Utah Avalanche Center, the nonprofit side and the Forest Service side. Mark Staples is the director of the Forest Service side. But Paul Daigle comes up once a year, about this time every year, and we love to have him join us to talk about what's up at the Utah Avalanche Center. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Lynn and Chris. Thank you very much.
Great to have you. So, you know, it seems every year when you come, we do go back over that distinction about the Utah Avalanche Center, why there's a Forest Service side and why there's a nonprofit side.
Right. Originally, the center was just a Forest Service entity, and the nonprofit group was formed to help fundraise and help stabilize the center a little bit, because at that time, the Forest Service funding for avalanche forecasting was a variable every year, and we never knew if it was going to continue. So we put together the nonprofit side, and that portion of it has grown over the years to where we now provide about two-thirds of the funding for the whole program. We take care of all the education and awareness. We own the website and manage that. So we do a lot of the logistics, and the Forest Service really sticks with forecasting, reporting accidents, working with local media on current conditions.
So the awareness side has really grown. As I mentioned, the Know Before You Go campaign, you brought it to school children among many, many, many other groups. But this has grown in an interesting way that includes the Banff Film Festival.
Right. Well, we started out thinking we need an awareness program for kids. Kids are not taking our avalanche classes, which are very science-based, and we needed something really reflecting their needs. And we designed this for an eighth grade audience, and who knew, but it turns out we're all eighth graders inside. And yeah. So this, it really appeals to everyone. So we've been doing the program in Utah for 11 years now, and it's spread around the country a little bit. A few other programs have picked it up, but it's really has been a Utah-centric program. About a year and a half ago, we decided to do some updates, bring in some new music, new athletes, new footage. We got a couple of other groups on board. We got the Colorado Avalanche Information Center wanting to partner with this. We partnered with Avalanche Canada. We worked with some snow sports brands, and all of a sudden this morphed into becoming an international standard development effort for avalanche awareness. So we created a new video, we created a new slide deck, and the Know Before You Go program, for those of you who haven't seen it, is essentially a one-hour free program just to make people aware of avalanches. We want you to come out realizing that avalanches exist, that if you play in the snow, you're at risk of avalanches, and there's something you can do about it.
Yeah.
So is this one-hour program just a video-based, or is it hands-on? Is it demonstrations, et cetera? What does it involve?
The program, and we really keep it structured strictly to an hour, actually 50 minutes, so it'll fit into a school period.
Okay, so that's in my other way. So it is actually shown at schools?
Yes,
or delivered
and
to
it
schools?
Actually has a pretty tight structure. We can expand it for open groups where we don't have any time constraints, but it starts out with a 15-minute video, and that video is what Lynn referred to earlier. We've been working with professional filmmakers. We've developed our own essentially professional editing studio. And this year we entered and got accepted into the Banff Film Festival with that video, which is really exciting. I think it's the first time a PSA-type video has ever been in that film, in the festival.
Yeah. Right.
We went up for that, and it was really exciting to see film after film of people just sending it, you know, skiing big lines in Alaska and skiing in Russia and park tricks and things like that. And all of a sudden, here's a safety message that's got the same athletes and the same moves and the same riding, but saying, okay, this is what goes on behind the scenes. This is what the cool guys do.
Yeah.
And as you know, I mean, we're far more afraid of being considered dorks in the backcountry than being killed.
Right. So is it also something that visitors can take advantage of and see if they're here, they come here for a week, meaning are the resorts chipping in with providing some way of seeing this video too?
We have a handful of events scheduled throughout the winter. They're not done on a regular basis. It's not like you can go somewhere every night to see it. You can see it online. You can go to kbyg.org or to the UAC website, and it'll lead you to everything that you can watch online. But it's a lot more fun to watch it in person. At the moment, we don't have any Park City events on our calendar, but we will within the next few weeks. So we'll try and do something around town.
And it makes me wonder about specific groups. And I don't know why it flashed into my mind, but the Colony, say, HOA, you know, wanting to educate their residents. Could they call up the Utah Avalanche Center and say, hey, we'd love to have you come up and screen the Know Before You Go film?
Absolutely. Mm. We've done that before for the Colony. We've done it for Jeremy Ranch homeowners. We've done it at the Swanner, at UOP. We've actually done full-day classes on snow for Colony homeowners before, or really anybody that calls us up and says, hey, I've got a bunch of friends, and we want to learn something about avalanches.
Yeah, good. I always bring this up when we talk, because I know that Know Before You Go film, I've seen it. I haven't seen the updated version. I look forward to doing that. But my kids, who are now out of high school, in college, but when they viewed that, and maybe junior high, I think, is when they saw it, they decided that they knew everything about snow safety after seeing that 60-minute video. So what is your pitch? What would be your pitch to my kids?
My pitch would be that all you know is that it's dangerous and there's something you can do about it. There's a lot of specifics to learn. They're easy to learn, but you need to put in some time doing that. And the real key is, it's one thing to sit in a warm classroom and watch all this stuff. It's another thing to actually be out in the middle of a storm and be making smart decisions with peer pressure going on. If a rescue happens, I don't think people realize just how horrible a rescue is. It's stressful. You're cold. People are screaming. Your buddy or your partner is buried. It's terrible.
Right.
And the way you learn how to deal with that is just how pilots learn how to fly aircraft in bad situations and how soldiers learn. You go through training. And it's rugged training.
Right, right. So I would imagine that you guys keep a calendar of which private entities like White Pine are doing snow safety weekend courses or that sort of thing.
Yep. If you go to utahavalanchecenter.org and look on the education tab, you'll see everything in the state of Utah that we're aware of related to avalanche education.
Okay. Hey, just a quick question about the skiers skiing the steep lines in Alaska, some of these that are now on your new film. I always wonder that when I see ski movies, how that sort of promotes skiing dangerous slopes, do you think? Because I see them and it seems as though they're skiing in a slough, which to me looks like an avalanche, and they're doing it with, you know, joy, not with panic. What do you think about that?
You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. It worries us that they do promote what looks like dangerous behavior. What we're showing in Know Before You Go is generally the people that are doing that are taking pretty careful precautions. They're checking stability. They're going out in conditions where they can get away with that. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they do get caught, and there are accidents. Those people are pushing the limits, and I think there's always going to be a part of our population that wants to do that. I think for a lot of us, though, we want to keep doing this year after year. And you can do that, especially recognizing that there's days that you can ski steep lines in the Wasatch. There's days that you can ski deep powder. You can ski steep lines. There's other days that you dial it back a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about technology. Every year there seems to be some new types of technology, either in the area of detection or forecasting or communications or emergency response. What's anything new this year?
I'd say there's nothing revolutionary this year. We're continuing to work on communication channels. Rescue gear continues to get incrementally better. Airbag packs seem to me like they're entering a new generation where the weight is coming down, which was one of the obstacles for a lot of people. I'd say there's lots of small improvements, but nothing that really stands out as earth-shaking right now.
And going back to that idea of risk taking, you know, we've talked about this before. The idea of technology advancing, providing improved, let's say, safety or response, and how that relates to risk taking, right? That classic idea. Well, I've got my airbag, therefore I can push the envelope a little more. Mm-hmm. You know, you're constantly having to address that attitude, right?
Yep, absolutely. And actually, there's people that spend careers studying that exact mm-hmm. phenomena, and it's called risk homeostasis. Mm-hmm. And the theory goes that you give somebody a new safety tool, and they increase their risky behavior a little bit. An example is that you put an airbag in your car, and you drive a little bit faster. And then you put 7 airbags in your car and anti-lock brakes, and you drive a little bit faster. And so every time, and historically this has been shown over and over, every time you increase a factor of safety, the accident rate goes down, but not as much as you'd expect because of that factor. But the good news is it does go down. And the reality is, would any of us now drive in a car without a seatbelt or without an airbag? Would any of us go out in the backcountry without an avalanche transceiver? No. Does it affect our behavior? Yeah. Science tells us that subconsciously it does, but it's still a good idea.
Right. Side country. Is side country now the scariest thing for folks like you?
Absolutely. Side country scares me more than anything else. Some people don't.
And real quick, what is side country?
So some people don't like the term.
Okay.
It's areas right outside the resort boundary. It's not considered part of the resort. It's not controlled for avalanches or mitigated. But you can get there from a lift. You don't have to put out a lot of effort. You don't have to walk to it. You don't need climbing skins. You don't need gear. You don't need partners. And as a result, it's like a grizzly bear wandering around in your backyard. And you're thinking, oh, it's in my backyard. That's got to be safe. I can see it from my living room. It turns out it's still a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
And when you go wandering out there, it's still a grizzly bear. And so side country bothers us a lot. People, mainly, it's just as dangerous as the backcountry, but people don't realize it. And they don't take adequate precautions.
Okay, right. Because their attitude is, I'm still near controlled property. Therefore,
right.
If I get in trouble, the response or emergency response is nearby, et cetera. So again, it lends itself to kind of a sense of over security or so.
Right. And they see the signs, and I don't think they quite get it, that on the other side of this fence, the patrol doesn't do any kind of work. And so when you're on your own. You can see it from a lift, but it doesn't mean it's any safer.
Will it ever be closed? I mean, I know the reason that the gates are there is because you cannot close off access to Forest Service land. Is that kind of how it goes? And will there ever be...
In general terms, yes.
Yeah. Will it ever be closed? I mean, it seems like there's a great argument for it. People are dying out there.
You know, I hope it never is. I hope that I always have the ability to go out in the backcountry and choose and manage my own risk. And I think a lot of people feel the same
but
way.
I mean, from a ski resort where you're opening up the chance of people with no knowledge, skills, or equipment to be in the backcountry.
I think I think what everybody would like to see is a way of somehow making sure that everybody goes out through those gates, has the equipment, has the training, has the understanding of what they're doing. Now, does that mean someday making it to where you can't go out through those gates without safety gear or without showing that you've taken a class? I don't know. I think that's a reasonable thing to discuss.
Yeah.
Change the topic a little bit to the role of citizen science in helping to collect data. That's something you guys do, correct, and encourage others?
Absolutely. That's something we love. We have an observer program that we started many years ago, and we encourage people to get out in the backcountry and let us know what they find. We've got an online form they can fill out. There's lots of tools they can use to build a picture of a snow pit, a snow profile, the hardness levels in a snowpack. And we really depend on that observer network. We have some that work with us regularly that we pay a little bit to, but we really depend even more on the public. Just if you see something interesting in the backcountry, let us know because you are our eyes and ears.
Sounds like with our local business, Avatech Mountain Hub, they're launching a new app this month, next month. Spoke to them a couple weeks ago, which will take that observer network, you know, and grow it exponentially.
Absolutely. And they're working on a national network, which is really nice. Our model of an observer network has been spreading to other centers, but it's spotty and under different conditions. But I think having a national network is a great idea.
Yeah. So finally, just a couple minutes left. The numbers of people, we've heard that in the backcountry, that's like the only sector that is actually growing in ski sports is backcountry,
right?
Which is interesting. I haven't seen the actual statistic to support that claim, but there are more and more people going out in the backcountry. What's it mean?
Well, absolutely. There are a lot more people out in the backcountry. We don't know exactly because we don't have good counts. Recently, a study was done looking at contacts with users, so people that went to websites or called in on hotlines. They compared 1995 to 2015, and they came up with an estimate. There's somewhere between 15 and 60 times more people in the backcountry than there were 20 years ago.
Wow.
15 to 60 times. And if we'd kept the same fatality rate right. per user day, that means in Utah we'd be seeing somewhere between 45 and 240 avalanche deaths a year, which
and what are you
devastating.
Saying?
And we're seeing about three and a fraction. Mm-hmm. So we feel like this really is making an impact. And I think what's happening is you're seeing a lot more people in the backcountry, but you're seeing a lot higher level of education. Everybody talks about what the avalanche danger is today. You very seldom see a skier or snowboarder in the backcountry without an avalanche transceiver, probe, shovel. It's just become something you commonly talk about.
Yeah, good.
And those fatality rates are throughout the West, the same in basically every state. You're seeing
similar trends numbers. In all states.
Yeah. Yep.
We're seeing different user groups that are having issues. We're seeing more snowmobilers right. getting in accidents than we had 20 years ago. Fewer skiers. We're still having a significant portion of people that don't consider themselves backcountry users. There are people out on borrowed snowshoes walking their dog. There are people out on a fat tire bike. There are people out for a run on snow. And those are the ones that we really work hard to reach because they don't even know they're at risk.
Yeah. It's like this snowshoe. We always bring this up, but in Daly Canyon, just right up the street here, that met his untimely death, just snowshoeing and not seeing the steep slope above him. And, you know, he was just right there, a couple
Really?
You know, 300 or 400 yards up Daly Canyon.
Yeah.
You'd never know it.
It's something that doesn't make sense.
So always look above your steep slope, no matter what kind of sport you're doing.
We had another accident very similar 2 years ago. It was within almost a baseball throw of the road, and somebody was just walking up the bottom of a narrow, steep canyon, and a very small slide came down. And in a narrow, steep canyon, it doesn't take very much.
Right, to pile up. Wow. Well, any final thoughts that we need to know about?
Well, I'm just really excited to see snow here.
Oh,
I think normally when I come up to visit, there isn't much snow, but you know, we've got snow sticking to the mountains. I hope it continues to stick to the mountains, not fall off.
Yeah.
But I have high hopes for a great winter, but definitely want people to pay attention, learn a little bit about avalanches. It's nice. You learn more about the mountains. You learn more about the snow, the community. It's worthwhile learning about avalanches.
Right. And just to repeat, today's avalanche forecast, I heard part of it. I didn't even hear who was on this morning. And as we know, every day at about 8:10 during the local news hour, Leslie Thatcher hears from one of the forecasters at the Utah Avalanche Center. And I just remember hearing this morning, large slabs easily triggered.
Oh, right now, we've got really sneaky avalanche conditions. We've got what we've called a persistent weak layer problem. And what that means is deep in the snowpack, there is a weak layer that isn't going away anytime soon. And it's not terribly reactive. So people are getting away with skiing things. You see tracks on steep slopes and people are getting away with it. But there's a good chance that somebody will hit the trigger spot and trigger something really big and unsurvivable. So it's a very low likelihood, high consequence situation. And those make us nervous because we can't tell where and when it's going to happen. We know it probably will at some point. We know most people will get away with skiing steep slopes, but there's a bullet out there.
Right.
It's still zinging along and we don't want to be in front of it.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well.
So where do people go again? The website? Learn
Utah
more about
avalanchecenter.org.
Utah.
For everything avalanche related in Utah.
But what was that other website you mentioned? KBYG.
KBYG. It's the initials, the acronym for Know Before You Go. So KBYG.org. You can see the video there. You can learn about the program. You can learn how to get somebody to come deliver the program to you and your group.
Okay.
Excellent. We
Great.
Got it. Paul Daigle,
thanks, Paul.
Utah Avalanche Center's Executive Director. Thanks for joining us this
Thank
morning.
Thank you guys very much.
Thanks.
All right. And we'll be right back after this to talk about ski mountaineering with Chad Brackelsberg when we return.
Executive Chef Todd Cosgrove here with Park Meadows Country Club, a KPCW supporter. Park Meadows prepares seasonally inspired menus in our dining room, lounge, and outdoor patio areas year-round. We also offer members dining menus for social events throughout the year. Social and golf memberships are available. 649-2460 or parkmeadowscc.com.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Danny Warner, owner of Chateau Recovery, and proud to sponsor The Mountain Life on KPCW. Chateau Recovery, helping adults with substance abuse issues build a new life through acceptance, perspective, and empowerment. Information available at 866-808-4160 or chateaurecovery.com. Addiction is a disease, recovery is a choice.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Chris Cherniak, sitting in for Tim Henney. You know, Lynn, I've been thinking I may need a new sport for the winter.
I think you might.
Okay. Something that's good for me aerobically, cardiovascularly. Something I can do almost any hour of most days that gets me outside, away from crowds, breathing fresh air, test my fitness and agility. And joining us in the studio to help explain a new sport, or so to speak, maybe a new sport to many of us, is Chad Brackelsberg. And he's going to tell us why I, or anyone else for that matter, ought to pick up the sport of ski mountaineering. Otherwise, the idea of racing uphill and then racing back down again. Chad, thanks for joining us this morning on The Mountain Life.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, so give me, I have no concept of what ski mountaineering is, so give me a thumbnail sketch of what it's about.
Yeah, the sport of ski mountaineering has been around for close to 100 years, originating in France, and actually debuted in the original Winter Olympics in Chamonix in the early 1900s. And since then, it's been a big sport in Europe and has been slow to take off in the U.S., but over the past 15 years or so has really started to grow in the U.S.
Okay, so what's the concept here? I'm actually starting at the bottom of the hill and working my way up to some point.
So just think of backcountry skiing and take out either some of the backcountry portions or add in the race portions. So at the very basic level, it's fitness skinning, where people are really using it, the ski resorts, to get some exercise in the winter when they maybe don't want to ride their bike or run, and they don't necessarily want to be in the backcountry. From the race perspective, we go, you might climb 9,000 feet in a race over 2 to 4 hours, and it truly is an aerobic endurance feat to watch these racers literally running up the hill and skiing with premonitions down.
What kind of hill are we talking about? Elevation change?
It really can be almost anything. In the Wasatch here, we do races at Brighton mostly, and your climbs can be anywhere from 500 to 1,700 or 1,800 vertical feet per climb, and a race has anywhere from 3 to 5 climbs like that. Some of the bigger climbs in the nation, or some bigger races, you have climbs of 3 to 4,000 feet for a single climb, and doing those multiple times.
And what kind of skis are we using?
Definitely any gear works as an entry level to the sport. Your regular backcountry gear is just fine. When people get to more of the serious racers, there are specific race gear where the skis sort of reminiscent of something that your 10-year-old child might ski on. They're only about 65 millimeters underfoot and 165 centimeters in length. Very, very light, approximately, less than a kilogram for a ski skin and a binding. And the boots are, a pair of boots is just over a kilogram. So think of triathlon road bikes, and that's what the gear has really come to, and that's what pushes the bounds for the gear.
I'll never forget, I found a pair of Ski-Mo boots that felt like running shoes, about the same weight as running shoes. And I have to kind of wonder what that's like when you start going downhill. Do you get any support, any ankle support?
Yeah, the boots are now either a combination of plastic and carbon fiber or all carbon fiber, and they actually have more walkability than a standard hiking boot that you would buy for hiking in the summer. But when you lock them down, similar to a backcountry boot, being carbon fiber, they are as stiff as most four-buckle boots that you would tour with. So some are actually too stiff almost to be comfortable in the downhill mode.
Wow. How about that? Hey, just have to apologize. We had some technical difficulties with your microphone right in the first few seconds. So if you said the most important thing then and I was distracted. But what I wanted to ask you about is uphill policy, because I was thinking the other night how it sure would be nice to go skin up Park City Resort. And as of last year, they had a new uphill policy. I think that a lot of resorts are establishing an uphill policy because people are liking to travel uphill, after work or before work. So talk about those resorts and specifically Park City.
Yeah, we're working hard with a lot of the resort management right now to increase the amount of uphill policies that allow it, actually. And we're really, it's as I said earlier, it's what people are looking to do. They have an hour over their lunch break, they want to get some exercise, or they just don't want to go in the backcountry, but yet they want to climb uphill. It's a great off-season training if you're a serious biker or runner in the summer. Lynn, as you said, Park City did have a policy that they started last year. And it's, I believe, it's 4:30 in the afternoon until 8:30 in the morning. And it's up to the angle station from the main base area. So we're really excited to have that in town here. We continue to work with them trying to increase that policy to maybe get an all-day policy that takes people up a less traveled area, up one of the summer trails like Spiro or Armstrong, where they would not be in the way of the general public. Brighton has a great policy from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 9 in the morning. Snow Basin is open, I think, 24 hours a day for uphill, as is Nordic Valley. And we're working with other resorts all the time and continuing communication with them to get them to at least evaluate and implement some type of policy.
So just last year, I did some hiking early morning up Park City Resort, and I sort of forgot how, or I forget how it goes. You're supposed to stay on one side or the other. And obviously in the morning, there are snowmobiles going up and down and snow safety people, and you know, they're doing the last bits of grooming. So if you want to keep those uphill policies open and intact, what do we do as uphill travelers?
It's really about being a courteous uphill user. We're guests on their resort. As you said, they're busy trying to get the resort open for the day's traffic and the customers. And so, as you said, staying on the far right or left side, you know, similar to how you might ride a road bike, you know, no more than two abreast. Don't just climb up the middle of the slope to where if groomers or snowmobiles are coming down, they can't see you. If it's dark or low light, make sure you have a headlight on, preferably one that has a blinking red light in the back. Reflective clothing are good. The biggest concern for the resort management is an accident between a uphill skier and a resort worker, so a snowmobile or a snowcat. And you know, they're still learning to get used to seeing skiers climbing uphill, so they're just not used to looking for that kind of traffic at 6 or 7 in the morning when they're busy trying to get to work.
Or you said that these are available starting, or the times you said was, example, 4:30 to 8:30, 4:30 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. So on a full moon, you could do uphill activities at these resorts?
Correct. And full moon skiing is fantastic.
Right.
As tempting as it is, though, not to wear a headlamp because you do have the light of the moon, that is a big thing for the resorts that they can still see you.
Right. But it's okay to be out there while they're grooming and other activities. You know, there's like Lynn's saying, there's a lot of things going on in the middle of the night.
Right.
Just be aware. Okay.
That's correct. But, and that's one of the reasons that Park City actually doesn't open their policy until night skiing starts, which is in another week or two. And a lot of that is they still have a lot of snowmaking going on at night, and you know, they want to focus on getting the resort itself open. So I'm not sure the exact day this year that night skiing starts, but once night skiing starts, that is when the policy goes into effect.
Oh, okay, okay. I think, Chris, you should make your debut ski mountaineering on the next full moon.
Yeah, no.
I was actually thinking next Tuesday's race he should.
Yeah,
that's
what?
You're fit.
Next Tuesday's race?
So there is a series of races we have throughout the season. We have a local nonprofit, Utah Ski-Mo, that is their mission and goal is to increase the participation in the sport as well as education through clinics and races. And so we have an 8-race series in the Wasatch along with races at Logan, Ogden, and hopefully this year also Sundance. And overall, out of these just sort of informal races, we'll have about 16 this year. And next Tuesday is the first race of the season at 7 p.m. at Brighton.
Exciting. Okay. At Brighton. Okay. And so these are, most all of them are in the evening. Some on the weekends. And then the culmination, the crescendo is, of course, the powder keg. So you can talk about that one.
Yes. We have all, the series races are all either Tuesday or typically Tuesday or Friday nights, depending on the location. The two big races we have in Utah are the Crowbar race up in Logan, which is January 28th. And then sort of the end of the entire Utah season is the Wasatch Powder Keg, March 10th, 11th, and 12th up at Brighton, which is 3 days of racing, three different formats of racing, ranging from a short sprint race, which is anywhere from 3 to 5 minute race, up to a technical teams race, which is close to 9,000 feet of climbing and takes racers anywhere from 3 to 6 hours to complete.
Wow. And these, I assume, are out and back style courses or point to point?
Out and back, but we typically, if you look at the Brighton Mountain, we start on one end and climb up the front and then just send the back and do that sort of as a fan all the way across the resort.
Wow.
So you typically don't cross the same terrain twice.
So I noticed last year with the powder keg, one of the pieces of equipment that you needed was a Via Ferrata lanyard. And I thought, what are you clipping into? I mean, what else goes on in these races?
So it just really depends on the format of the race. We make our technical teams race, which is the Sunday race, sort of a graduate level race where we fix close to 2,000 feet of rope up the a couloir called the elevator on Mount Millicent. And you use an ascender and a via ferrata for safety as you climb up the rope up that couloir, and then are attached to also to a traversing rope down the steep ridge line until you ski back down where it's a little more gradual.
So you're down climbing a steepy, rocky descent with your ski boots on, hooked into a rope so you won't fall. Your skis are on your back, I assume, at that point.
And that's where we really try to bring back the mountaineering aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, right. Ski mountaineering racing in the U.S. has sort of gotten a bad rap of just climbing up groomers at ski resorts. And so we are really trying to bring the mountaineering aspect back into it.
But after speaking with Paul Daigle, I mean, do I need to be also concerned with avalanche issues if we're out backcountry, conditions like that?
We do take a lot of precautions for that. So we have safe courses, and depending on avalanche conditions, we vary the course per the day, per climb. So depending on snow overnight, wind overnight, daytime heating, we're always prepared to change any aspect of the course that we may have to.
Okay.
So one of the areas of this sport that you're trying to expand is the younger population. And we know that at the Utah Olympic Park last year, and I'm not sure about this year, maybe you can update us on that, that there was a program led by world champion ski mountaineer Nina Silich, right?
Yep. So Nina started a youth program last year at UOP, and it was very successful. It will be happening again this year. We're working on just kind of putting the final touches on an overall youth program where we will have so far three different youth programs, another one in Silver Fork in Big Cottonwood, and then a school program at one of the schools in Salt Lake City. And so the goal, again, part of the goals of the nonprofit organization is to increase participation. And so we feel that the youth is a great aspect for that. But just before the Summer Olympics, the IOC approved the ISMF, which is the International Ski Mountaineering Federation, for inclusion in the Winter Olympics. Oh. And we're not sure if it's 2022 or 2026, but you know, we feel that the 14 to 18 year olds are the group of people who will be racing in those Olympics. So we're working hard across the entire nation to build up these youth programs.
Oh, isn't that great? Because this is a huge sport in Europe. I'm sure there are all kinds of kids cruising around the mountains there.
It is. It's common to have young kids, and it's even at the races, it's common to have, you know, 1,000 people that have climbed to the top of the peak to cheer on racers and, you know, just line the course everywhere. Huge races with very big budgets put on by one of the larger races actually is put on by the Swiss military. And so they have a huge support nationally from the countries in Europe. And so hopefully that's where we'll get to in the next few years.
That sounds great. Again, the race series, about 16 different races. Did you manage to pull one off here in Park City? Is that going to happen this year, or
we're working on it still? We hope so.
We would like to have a race that's also sort of a party. Can we arrange that? Right? Where you maybe race up to, you know, some mountain lodge.
Right.
In a tutu. And then you have, you know, some food and beverage. I realize the beverage part, that's the sticking point, isn't it?
So we do try to, the weekend races, we do try to make very much an event. And so even you can race in a tutu if you want, Lynn. We'll gladly accept that. And we do always have a barbecue.
You win that division. Let's put it that way.
We've had people race in costumes many years, and it can be pretty funny. But we do always try to have a social gathering after all the races to make it a fun event that's inclusive to everybody.
Yeah. Don't most of the ski-mo racers race in costume? I think I've seen Paul Daigle in a one-piece Lycra suit. That seems like a costume.
It is sort of a costume. When we're a bunch of skinny men and women out there in one-piece spandexes can get a little comical.
It's a pretty good look. All
so
right.
Is this going to evolve into some type of triathlonic activity where you ski-mo, and then you hop on a fat bike, and then you jump in the Jordanelle at some point, you know. Is there anything like that?
There are some of those events around the U.S. There aren't any in Utah. I don't foresee, at least from my perspective of starting. I probably won't get involved in starting one. It's enough work to put on the races
One event.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so where do you go to find out about the races, and how can Chris sign up?
So you can go for more information to utahschemo.org, and there's an information page. There's a calendar with all the races, as well as a membership page. The entire 16-race series only costs you $45, so we try to make it extremely low cost so that it's open to everybody. From there, there's also then links to the Wasatch Powder Keg and Crowbar, which are run separately and you register for separately.
Okay, and again, I can still show up with my 40-pound bindings, my 35-pound boots, and still make a go of it. It's okay.
Yes. We definitely have half of our racers are still on their standard backcountry gear with no special gear, and they're just out there to have fun and to get some exercise in the dark under headlamps some night.
Yeah. Perfect. Okay. It's a great time. Chad Brackelsberg, Utah Schemo, thanks for joining us today.
Chad. Thanks, Lynn and Chris.
And stay with us. We'll be right back with Trails Guru Bob Radke. He's going to talk about another winter sport. When we return, it's The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
Support for KPCW comes from the Wasatch Brew Pub, offering weekend brunch at the top of Main Street, featuring traditional favorites as well as midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub, misbehaving in Utah since 1986. WasatchBeers.com.
Explore the place where Olympic dreams came true in 2002. Utah Olympic Park is open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Stroll through the free Alf Ingen Ski Museum and Eccles 2002 Olympic Winter Games Museum, or take a guided tour and learn the inner workings and remarkable stories of this amazing Olympic venue.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Great to have you here, Chris. Okay, so we started off with avalanche safety. Then we moved into ski mountaineering, your next new winter sport. And now a sport very near and dear to my heart. We'll talk a little bit here about Nordic skiing. I mean, we may love our winter trails nearly as much as our summer trails. And it turns out that we're adding a few more kilometers to the mix. And joining us now in the studio is local trails guru at Basin Recreation, Bob Radke. Good morning, Bob.
Morning, Lynn. Good morning, Chris.
I hope that's not false advertising. We are adding a few more kilometers, right?
Yes. The new trail this year is out at the open space that was purchased few years ago, the Gilmore parcel that is out by Trailside Park in the Silver Summit area. There's 300 acres there. Heinrich Dieters, the city owns the property, and they have this fall constructed a trailhead, a formal trailhead there on the property. And Mountain Trails Foundation went out and mowed a cross-country ski loop on the property. And Basin Rec is going to groom it for them this winter.
That is some fine collaboration.
Yes.
It's land in the county, owned by the city, mowed by Mountain Trails Foundation, and groomed by Basin Rec. I like that.
Yes, it's working it pretty smoothly here. So it's been a great collaboration, and it's going to be a great little amenity. It does not connect to the rest of the Round Valley Trail system currently. So it's a little isolated system. I measured it. It's about 2 kilometers loop. It's going to be the flattest loop in our area, I believe. So it's going to be a great little beginner trail.
Right, right.
And it is in an off-leash dog area.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yes. And so that makes kind of a nice little place to go get a nice flat ski or walk in.
Okay. Yeah. Is it open yet?
No.
Okay.
A
few more inches.
Right. Yeah. So it's just a mowed sagebrush. So it's a little rough out there.
Right.
We need a little snow.
Okay, right. And you said that it's flat, so the technical doesn't require any great technical skills to manage.
No, it's okay. it's gonna be a really nice little loop just for beginners.
Okay, yeah, so great. So I can go out there with my pup. I can also walk that if I want. Can I ride my fat tire bike?
Conditions permitting.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
So it's
once
all,
the snow sets
all
up,
access
gets hard.
In that sense.
Yes.
Okay.
So I know that a lot of people have been watching that trailhead go in. It's huge. I mean, that's a good thing, I guess, because you know what kind of demand is for the trails out in that area. But why is it so big?
I'm not sure. It's a city project, and so and,
we'll talk to the city.
Talk to Heinrich. We are plowing it, you know, basin, right? Since it's in our backyard, I mean, our offices, facilities are right there. So we're going to plow the trailhead, groom the trail. So it's just easy for us. So,
are there any plans to make a connection between that trail? All right. So
yes, they do have, it's a little landlocked or some terrain to negotiate to get into Round Valley from there. But it is in the plans.
Right. So you could sort of go to the east towards the other trail side trailhead where those trails begin. Is
right,
that
at
kind
the
of
Highland Drive trailhead. Mm-hmm. You could, but there's private property there. So we're a little landlocked.
Oh, I
That's
see.
That's why
okay.
it wasn't connected. It's not connected because it's a little challenging right now.
Okay. So you groom how many kilometers of trail overall during the winter? So many.
Well, like, I'm not sure how many, like, with all three entities here going, White Pine Touring, Round Valley with Mountain Trails in the city, and then what Basin Rec does, there's got to be close to 75, 80 kilometers.
Right, right.
I
think that's about right from what I recall. But
no,
Basin.
Because we,
About that?
It's about that.
We seem to add a little bit every year. But in terms of just what Basin Recreation does, you do, talk a little bit about each place you do.
Right, so I guess our main area is, you know, we call it our Willow Creek Park area where we start and head out. And we'll start there and we groom the McLeod Creek Trail from the market at Park City in town all the way to Kimball Junction. And then around the Willow Creek Park area, we groom another 4 kilometers of trail with classic lanes set there. Matt Canute Park, we have another 2 kilometers groomed there. It's all connected to the McLeod Creek Trail to Kimball Junction. And then we groom all the way to the field house. Once we're there, we go under the pedestrian underpass, under Highway 248, groom on the Millennium Trail back to Park City Nursery, and adds another 3+ kilometers there. And then at the open space at Kimball Junction, beneath the Utah Olympic Park, we groom another 5 kilometers of ski-only trail there. The rest of it's all multi-use. Hmm. And then out of Ecker Hill Middle School, we do a little one-mile track. It's not very much. Up at the woods at Parley's Lane, we do another 1 mile little loop up there. And it's great little getaway. They're quiet little places, but get used. People find them and serve their needs. So this year we're adding lights to the 5K.
Wow.
So we kind of sneak some lights out in the trees. So we're going to light the upper loop.
Are those solar powered?
Yeah,
or?
They're little just solar powered landscape lights.
Right.
Fairly inexpensive. I think we have about 40 of them. We put 20 out last year. Just kind of a little trial thing to see what the visual impacts would be. And, I mean, there's just like
you
nil.
Can't see.
You can't see it. So we're going to try to aim them away from the junction area as best we can and light the trail and the corners and all that. So it'll be something new. So after hours skiing at the Basin 5K.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's great. I remember years ago at Sundance, they had little lanterns lighting the way on their Nordic ski track. It's a really nice touch, too.
Yeah.
Okay. You got all these trails. I have to ask, any plans for additional trails going? Master plan type of?
Well, we have some in the future. We're kind of landlocked right now. I don't know how much we can expand. And it all depends on the properties around us developing or things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I certainly have my radar on a few that we can expand to, but, you know, they're just on other people's properties. And One thing that is in the future is Hyatt Ranch. You know, that is, it's, you know, the Basin Rec purchased or bought the conservation easement a number of years ago. It's still privately held by the previous, by the landowner. We have an option to take title. I think it's in about 11 years from now. We do have plans to connect Ecker Hill Middle School over to the Basin 5K and stuff on for a little connection trail, and it'll be pretty cool there. But you know, we have to take title to the property before that can happen.
Okay.
Remind us. So everyone knows the Hyatt Ranch because it's really visible from the frontage road or I-80. But it's not the whole ranch, right? Isn't it just like the back part?
No. Yeah, I think so. The whole thing's under conservation easement.
Okay.
And the front part. Yeah, I'm not
the front part would not be touchable, right? Trying to remember how this all goes.
Me too.
Yeah. Okay.
It's,
well, when it comes
involved.
Back again, we'll explore some of the complexities of those conservation easements.
Right.
But those could in the future then
produce a
trail.
Yeah, in the future. It's long range and you know, there's other little thing pockets here and there.
But. Great. Have about a minute left. Anything more that we should know about that's going on with the trails?
We need more snow. It looks like Mountain Trails got a little bit groomed yesterday out at Quinn's Junction. We went out and looked at everything, and we just the ground is too warm. It's melting the snow from the bottom up. So these cold temperatures are going to help us get that settled down. And the next snowfall later in the week, hopefully, you know, we can get out and start packing.
Is there a website people can go to see the current conditions?
Yes, we basinrecreation.org. We have our trails conditions and a grooming report on that list. We also, if you want to get on our grooming report email that we send out when we groom, then send us an email at trails@basinrecreation.org.
Okay, sounds great. Trails Director for Basin Rec, Bob Radke, thanks for getting out of your grooming machine, shall we say, and coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
All right.
Thanks, Bob.
And this is The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Hospital. We're part of the not-for-profit Intermountain Healthcare System and proudly support KPCW. Park City Hospital is one of the premier hospitals for orthopedic surgery and follow-up care. Whether you need your hip, hand, knee, shoulder, ankle, or elbow fixed, our team of skilled orthopedic surgeons can put you back together, and our physical therapists can help you regain your strength and get you back to your active lifestyle. You can learn more about all the PT services offered at parkcityhospital.org or by calling 435-658-7350.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. And Chris Cherniak, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, as always.
We may see you again next week.
Okay.
I want to thank our underwriters, the doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinics, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, Chateau Recovery, and the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
Thank you. Thank you all.
And it was nice to talk all about snow today and snow sports.
Yeah, I guess so. since I'm probably going to be in Florida January and February this year.
Yeah.
So,
well,
talk all you want.
Okay. But
I'll let you
someday
know how
you've got to try
it.
That ski mountaineering. It's a hoot.
All right.
And it's great exercise.
You go first.
You go second.
All right. Deal.
You're listening to KPCW Park City. Time for news.